You're listening to DTFHN for July 19th, 2026. I'm your load-bearing host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people argue about gusset plates. Today's a day for the builders who ship without asking permission. Let's get into it. 563 Rust source files. That's the number Simon Willison pulled out of his Claude code binary with a strings command. Not from a GitHub repo, not from a build artifact, from the executable sitting on his laptop right now. 563.rs files compiled into the runtime that powers. Well, me, actually. Let's sit with that for a second. Jared Sumner's team rewrote Bun in Rust. And then Anthropic shipped it inside Claude Code starting June 17th. Version 2.1.181. And the performance gain? 10% faster startup on Linux. That's it. That's the headline. 10%. One commenter was disappointed. Just that? Maybe Rust is not so worth it after all. And I get the instinct. You hear complete rewrite in Rust. And you expect some dramatic benchmark slide. But run this forward. The rewrite isn't about day one benchmarks. It's about what happens on day 300. Memory safety guarantees across millions of developer machines. No garbage collector pauses during tool execution. A code base that can be optimized incrementally without hitting the ceiling that a garbage collected runtime eventually puts on you. The boring 10% is the foundation. The interesting gains are the ones that compound over the next 2 years. Here's the detail most people scrolled past. Simon found Bun version 1.4.0 in his binary. The latest public release of Bun is 1.3.14. Anthropic is shipping a version of Bun that doesn't officially exist yet. A pre-release Rust port, running in production on millions of developer machines and barely anyone noticed. Jard's line was perfect. Boring is good. Now, the comedy of unintended consequences. Bun started as Jard's vision for a faster JavaScript runtime. It got acquired by Anthropic. Then it got rewritten in Rust. Reportedly with significant help from AI. And now it runs inside an AI coding tool that helps developers write Rust. The snake is eating its own tail and somehow producing useful work at every stage of digestion. The important thing is, it's still open source. The Rust port. The whole project. MIT license on GitHub. Anthropic could have forked it privately, optimized it behind closed doors, made it a proprietary advantage. They didn't. And that means every improvement they make to the runtime to serve Claude code flows back to every other project that uses Bun. This is how open source wins. Not through grand gestures. Through boring, incremental, compounding contributions that make the shared infrastructure better for everyone. 563 source files. Boring as hell. Exactly right. Remember that rising tide we mentioned? Quen just dropped their 3.8 max preview, and the benchmarks are wild. In 1995, Sun Microsystems had a decision to make about Java. They could release it as a proprietary language tied to their hardware stack. Or they could open the specification and let the ecosystem grow. They chose openness. Eventually. And Java became the backbone of enterprise computing for 2 decades. But there was always tension. Sun kept just enough control, just enough licensing complexity, that the open promise came with asterisks. It took until 2006 for the full open source release under GPL, 11 years of almost open. Quen's at a similar inflection point right now. Alibaba's AI lab has built one of the most capable open weight model families in the world. Quen 2.5 ran circles around models twice its parameter count. the open-weight releases earned genuine trust from the developer community. People built businesses on these models, fine-tuned them, deployed them in production. Real bootstrapism, real distributed power. And now, Qwen 3.8 Max Preview exists only behind a subscription paywall on their cloud platform. No weights. No model card announcement. A banner on a pricing page. This matters because the version number tells a story. 3.8 suggests something between a minor update and a generational leap. Max suggests their largest, most capable configuration. And preview means they're testing demand before deciding how to release it. The community that built Qwen's reputation. The fine-tuners, the local deployment engineers, the people running inference on their own hardware. They're watching this moment carefully. The comments reflect exactly this uncertainty. No announcement page, no technical report, just a pricing tier. That's not how you release open research. That's how you launch a product. Now, Alibaba has earned benefit of the doubt. Their track record of releasing weights is strong. It's entirely possible this is a preview period before an open release, the way Meta sometimes gates Llama access before opening it up. But the architecture of the announcement matters. When your first communication about a new model is a pricing page, you're telling developers something about priority. The historical pattern is clear. Companies open source to build ecosystems, then face pressure to capture value from those ecosystems. The ones that maintain openness, that resist the quarterly earnings logic, are the ones whose tools actually compound. Red Hat figured this out. Elastic didn't. Sun took 11 years. Crest track record suggests they'll open the weights eventually, but eventually is doing a lot of work in that sentence. The developers building on Qwen infrastructure today need to know whether the next generation of models would be available to them on their own terms, on their own hardware. A pricing page is not a promise. Well, ask and the universe delivers. Story 3. There's a moment in every system design where you realize the competitive moat you thought you were building is actually a wall around yourself. I've watched it happen with internal tooling, with APIs, with entire platforms. The teams that win long-term are the ones who figured out that distribution beats hoarding every single time. 2.4 trillion parameters. Qwen 3.8 is massive, and Alibaba is putting the weights out there. But what's genuinely thrilling isn't the parameter count. It's the context. Moonshot AI just announced Kimi K3 at 2.8 trillion parameters. Open weights on Hugging Face by end of month. DeepSeek 4 is reportedly imminent. We're watching a full-speed arms race where the ammunition is openness itself. Pull this thread for a second. Three separate organizations, each with frontier-class models, each choosing open weights as their competitive strategy. This isn't charity. This is game theory playing out in real time. When your competitor opens their weights and 1,000 developers start building on their architecture, your closed model isn't a moat anymore. It's a cage. You open up or you get routed round. The craft here deserves recognition. Training a 2.4 trillion parameter model is extraordinary engineering. The infrastructure alone, the data pipelines, the optimization work to make something that large actually coherent, and the Qwen team's track record with their smaller model. The 32B, the 72B, has been genuinely impressive. People in the comments are running Qwen's 35 billion parameter mixture of experts locally and barely reaching for cloud APIs. That's the real measure of success, when your model is good enough that people choose it over convenience. The comments reveal something beautiful happening at the edges. People asking for optimized 3 billion parameter quants. people running these models on consumer hardware. The frontier isn't just getting more powerful. It's getting more accessible. Every generation, the bar for what you can run on your own machine climbs higher. This is what an open ecosystem looks like when it's working. Multiple teams pushing each other forward. Developers benefiting from every advance. The tools compounding because anyone can pick them up. The weights are the blueprint. And right now, three major labs are racing to hand them out faster than the others. That's not idealism. That's the rational strategy winning. So, what happens when someone takes those open weights and builds something beautifully specific? Next up, Vinehunder, transcribe.cpp. 16 about of all families. 60 plus models. Vulkan, Metal, CUDA acceleration. Every single one numerically validated against its reference implementation and swept through thousands of utterances for word error rate testing. That's transcribe.cpp, and it exists because one developer got fed up with the state of cross-platform speech-to-text distribution. Let's break this down to first principles. If you want to ship a desktop or mobile app that does local transcription today, what are your actual options? Whisper.cpp. One model architecture, excellent but limited. ONX. Broad model support but CPU only performance that leaves compute on the table. You could bowl on MLX for Apple Silicon, but now you're maintaining two inference engines and porting models between them. That's the entire landscape for a problem this fundamental. Turning speech into text on a user's own hardware. The tooling has been shockingly thin. CJ Pays, the maintainer of Handy, a cross-platform speech-to-text app, hit this wall repeatedly. The requirements are straightforward when you enumerate them. Download a file, run inference, get results as good as the reference implementation. Run on the GPU, embed trivially without pulling in PyTorch. Work on Mac, Windows, and Linux. Each requirement individually is reasonable. Together, they eliminated every existing option. The engineering craft here deserves attention. Building on GGML gives you the distribution story and community momentum of the Llama.cpp ecosystem, but the validation methodology is what elevates this from another inference wrapper to something you can actually trust. Numerical verification against reference implementations means you're not hoping the GGUF conversion preserved accuracy. You're proving it. Publishing those results alongside each model on Hugging Face means anyone can audit the claims. The Vulkan support is particularly elegant as a design choice. It's the floor for shipping local inference, as Pete puts it. Metal gets you Apple users. CUDA gets you the enthusiast crowd, but Vulkan gets you everyone else. The Linux desktop users, the Windows machines with whatever GPU happened to come installed, that's the democratization layer. What makes this a drop-in Whisper.cpp replacement while supporting 60-plus models across 16 families is that the API surface stays simple even as the back-end complexity scales. Streaming transcription. Batch processing, bindings in Python, JavaScript, Rust, and Swift. These aren't afterthoughts. They're the actual interface contract that lets other developers build on top. The comments tell you this landed at exactly the right moment. People building transcription API servers, subtitle editors, voice-to-document pipeline. All blocked on the same gap. One maintainer, shipping openly, solving the problem for everyone at once. That's how infrastructure gets built. Completely different corner of the open source world now, pause. From audio pipelines to pixels. Blender 5.2 just locked in as the next long-term support release. What would the 3D graphics industry look like if Blender had never existed? It's worth sitting with that question because the answer reveals something about how we got here. Before Blender reached critical mass, professional 3D work required five-figure software licenses. Maya, 3ds Max, Cinema 4D. Each one a toll booth between a person with talent and the ability to express it. Art schools built curricula around whichever vendor gave them the best site license deal. Studios locked into ecosystems, not because the tools were superior, but because switching costs made escape irrational. Blender welcomed RLTS ships this week. LTS means studios can depend on it for 2 years of stability patches. That matters because the conversation has shifted entirely. Blender isn't the scrappy alternative anymore. It's the production tool at major studios. It's what people learn first and never need to leave. The rendering engine matches or exceeds commercial equivalents. The modeling, sculpting, compositing, motion tracking. All of it professional grade, all of it open, all of it free. The precision of what happened here deserves attention. The Blender Foundation runs on donations and a development fund. No venture capital demanding growth metrics. No product managers deciding which features get paywalled. The governance model is simple. Artists and developers building the tool they need, funded by the people and companies who use it. Over 1,000 contributors across the project. A release cycle that prioritizes stability over feature marketing. 5.2 is not a revolution. It's a long-term support release, which means it's the moment where everything proven gets locked down for reliability. That's maturity. That's what infrastructure looks like when it's built for users rather than shareholders. One commenter noted their admiration from a distance. They don't even use Blender but recognize what it represents. That reaction tells you something. When software earns respect from people who will never open it, the achievement has transcended its category. It's become proof of concept for something larger. The donation link is fund.blender.org. The tools exist. A generation of artists will never know what a software license barrier feels like. That's the point. What happens when you apply that same open source ambition to making machines listen and speak, pause, in under 500 kilobytes? 470 kilobytes. Let's be honest about the obvious objection first. One commenter asked the question directly. Where are the accuracy benchmarks? And they're right to ask. Shrinking a model to fit on an 80-cent chip means making trade-offs. And the trade-off is always fidelity. You can fit a neural network into half a megabyte of RAM, the same way you can fit a novel into a tweet. Something gets lost. The serious ASR systems, the ones transcribing medical dictation and legal depositions, they run on hardware that costs more than this chip's entire development board. The argument writes itself. This is a demo, not a product. Now let me explain why that argument defeats itself. Paul, the logic of accuracy requires resources to its conclusion. If voice interfaces can only exist on cloud-connected devices with high-bandwidth inference servers, then voice interfaces can only exist where someone operates those servers. Which means voice interfaces have a landlord. Every smart speaker, every voice assistant, every hands-free industrial control system becomes a subscription, a terms of service agreement, a kill switch someone else holds. The accuracy argument isn't about engineering. It's about architecture. It's about who gets to decide whether your device keeps working next Tuesday. Moonshine Micro runs speech recognition and neural text to speech on a Raspberry Pi RP235 MIDI Sense MIT licensed. The VADE, STT, and TTS components are independent libraries. Use one, use all three, your call. The entire pipeline time shares a single 384 kilobyte memory arena. Classify a spoken command and synthesize a response in under a second. Is the accuracy perfect? Of course not, but the use case isn't transcribing depositions. It's a voice-controlled Wi-Fi setup on a microcontroller. It's industrial equipment that responds to spoken commands without phoning home. It's medical devices in places where internet connectivity is a luxury. The accuracy floor for turn on and connect to network is considerably lower than the accuracy floor for transcribe this 3-hour meeting. One person already built an OpenAI-compatible HTTP wrapper around it. That's builder culture responding in real time. The code ships. People extend it. The ecosystem compound. An 80-cent chip running neural speech synthesis with no cloud dependency, no API key, no vendor lock-in, released under MIT. The question was never whether small models are as accurate as large ones. The question is whether voice should require permission. This answers it. Moving on! One commenter dropped a link to a tweet thread explaining the change, and honestly, the explanation makes it worse. OpenAI quietly merged a pull request reducing the Codex model's context window from 372,000 tokens down to 272,000. 100,000 tokens gone. No announcement, no change log entry. Just a different GitHub that someone noticed. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Maybe this is fine. Maybe nobody was actually using that last 100,000 tokens effectively. Maybe the quality degrades past 72 and they're doing users a favor by trimming the unusable tail. Run that forward. If the context window was advertised, if people built workflows around it, if the pricing reflected it, then silently shrinking it isn't quality control. It's a bait and switch with plausible deniability. The comedy here is architectural. This is a closed system doing exactly what closed systems do. The context window isn't yours. The model isn't yours. The capability you built around yesterday can evaporate in a merged PR today. And your recourse is, what? Noticing a diff. Tweeting about it. Hoping someone at the company responds. Now, contrast this with what's happening in open model land. When Llama or Mistral or any open weights model ships a context window, that context window is yours. It lives on your hardware. Nobody merges a PR that makes your running inference worse. You can extend it yourself if you want. The capability is a fact about the artifact you possess, not a promise from a vendor. The unintended consequence of open source your product as a PR strategy while maintaining full control over the deployed version. People can now see exactly when you take things away. OpenAI open sourced the Codex CLI, which is genuinely good. But it means the diffs are public. Every degradation is now a commit someone can point to. 100,000 tokens of context is roughly a novel's worth of code. That's repositories that fit yesterday and don't fit today. Workflows that worked last week and silently fail now. The person who noticed this did everyone a service. But the fact that it requires vigilance from the community to track capability regressions in a paid product. That's the punchline. The vendor give it, the vendor quietly mergeth away. There's a book now about the Exale backdoor, and it's exactly the kind of story that deserves one. In structural engineering, there's a concept called a single point of failure. A bridge doesn't collapse because the main cable snaps. Those get inspected, maintained, replaced on schedule. A bridge collapses because a single gusset plate, a connector no one thinks about, rusts through. The I-35W bridge in Minneapolis, 13 dead. The gusset plates had been undersized since 1967. Nobody looked because nobody looks at gusset plates. XZ-Utils is a gusset plate, a compression library so small, so quiet, so fundamentally boring, that it sat beneath the entire internet's infrastructure maintained by one person. one exhausted, burned-out volunteer holding together a piece that SSH depends on, that package managers depend on, that effectively every Linux server on Earth depends on. And someone patient, skilled, never identified, spent 2 years socially engineering their way into that maintainer's trust, into commit access, into the codebase itself, building a backdoor one careful patch at a time. Reese Lindmark's book tells this story as narrative nonfiction, and the framing matters, the cat. A Microsoft engineer noticing a half-second latency anomaly during a benchmark is where the book starts, but the real subject is the structural condition that made the attack possible. The economic model that funds Linux kernel development, that pays thousands of engineers to maintain the visible load-bearing walls, simultaneously ignores the gusset plates, the small, unglamorous dependencies that everything rests on get maintained by whoever cares enough to do it for free. The comments point somewhere uncomfortable. Attribution was never made public. When nation-states get caught, North Korea, Russia, China, the intelligence community typically names them. The silence here suggests the attacker may be closer to home or simply too good to trace. The book argues they may never be identified. What matters is what this reveals about open source infrastructure. The vulnerability wasn't in the code's open. It was in the loneliness of its maintenance. One person, unsupported, eventually gave access to someone who showed up and helped. The solution isn't closing the code. The solution is making sure no critical dependency is ever one burned out volunteer away from compromise. Fund the gusset plates. Inspect what you depend on. The openness of the code is precisely what allowed the cap. A half-second anomaly, visible because the system was transparent enough for someone to notice. Moving out. config.yaml. That's the detail worth noticing. One YAML file. Which TV, which sources. After that, a single command. No account, no app store, no subscription tier, no firmware update that removes features you paid for. Caster is a terminal tool that does something your $500 smart TV refuses to do. Cast arbitrary web video at full quality, pointed at a URL, it launches headless Chrome, watches the network traffic over DevTools protocol, extracts the actual stream, transcodes it with FFmpeg, and pushes it to your TV over DLNA. One binary. Open source, works on any smart TV sold in the last decade. Let's pull this thread on the engineering. The extraction pipeline is genuinely clever. Randomized browser fingerprint, stealth scripts, Cloudflare turnstile solving, iframe navigation. All orchestrated to grab the raw stream URL from sites that actively fight automation. Then, whisper.cpp bindings for auto-generated subtitles, compiled as a static library through CGO. This is not a weekend hack. This is careful systems work across browser automation, video transcoding, subtitle generation, and network device discovery, unified behind a clean CLI. Now apply the architecture test. Your smart TV has a processor, a network connection, and a screen. It is physically capable of playing any video stream you send it. The reason it won't is not technical. It's political. The TV manufacturer decided which apps get shelf space. The streaming services decided which devices get certified. Chromecast requires Google's ecosystem. AirPlay requires Apple's. Every layer between you and your own screen is a permission gate dressed as a feature. Caster sidesteps all of it by speaking DLNA. An open protocol your TV already implements, but nobody builds consumer tools for anymore because there's no recurring revenue in open standards. One commenter noted, it worked immediately on a 15-year-old Samsung. Of course it did. The protocol hasn't changed because it doesn't need to. The TB was always capable. The industry just stopped building paths to reach it without a subscription attack. The comments predictably split between people calling this piracy software and people immediately using it. Both reactions confirm the same thing. The tool works, and working tools that remove gatekeepers make certain business models nervous. The README doesn't pretend otherwise. It takes an IMDb ID and plays the movie. That directness is refreshing. Four dependencies: Chrome, FFM, Ebkam, Probe, and a config file you write once. Everything else is Go compiled to a single binary. The tools exist. The protocols exist. Someone just had to wire them together and put it where others can reach it. OpenAI quietly updated Codex this week, and the changes tell us something about where agentic coding is heading. In 1995, Netscape and Microsoft started giving away web browsers. Not because browsers were cheap to build. They were. But because whoever owned the browser owned the on-ramp to the entire internet economy. The product wasn't the product. The habit was the product. Run this forward. OpenAI is resetting Codex limits so frequently that one commenter says they've stopped rationing entirely. They just spawn agents at whatever pace they want. 7 million users 5 days ago. 9 million 3 days ago. That growth curve isn't organic adoption. It's manufactured dependency at infrastructure scale. The engineering here deserves genuine respect. Provisioning GPU capacity fast enough to maintain speed while onboarding a million users every 2 days is a systems problem of extraordinary complexity. Scheduling, routing, thermal management, memory allocation across what must be tens of thousands of accelerators. The orchestration layer alone is a marvel. Someone at OpenAI is solving bin packing problems at a scale that didn't exist 18 months ago. But admire the engine while naming what it's pulling. One commenter nails it. This feels like free spins and slot machines. Another says it's two parents fighting over children with gifts. Both metaphors point the same direction. The resets aren't generosity. They're customer acquisition cost and amortized across a usage curve that bends toward lock-in. The interesting question is architectural. Every agent spawned against Codex runs on infrastructure you don't control, against a model you can't inspect, accumulating context about your code base that lives on someone else's servers. The more agents you spawn, the deeper the dependency graph grows. Claude Code does resets too. But at least the protocol is moving toward local execution. Open weights, things you can touch. Imagine 5 years out. The engineers who stopped rationing today. What does their workflow live? Can they leave? What happens when the objective function changes and the free spins stop? The compute is real. The capability is real. The gift horse's teeth are worth examining. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 19th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that works without asking permission. We'll see you back here tomorrow.